Thank you so much, Scott, for making this possible and for helping me get the sort of the word out of my book. It's been very, very exciting. And to the West Lafayette Public Library, which is hosting this. This is awesome. I've been a storyteller since I was born. I always tried to dive into the extra imagination part of everything that I was doing. In fact, friends of mine and I, whenever we got bored, we would just make up new games. We just invented things all the time. I've always been a storyteller, and I became a writer. There are a handful of stories that contributed to my becoming a writer, but the one that I like to tell, when I was a junior in college, I was in a class with my department chair. His name was Dr. Ed Ark. He was a great guy. It was a mass media and communication class. I got a paper back one afternoon. I looked at it, and on that paper was a B. And then below it, in his very careful script, Morris, if it wasn't for your great writing, I'm pretty sure this paper would have been a D. And so that was the day that I figured, hey, I'm pretty good at this writing thing. I should probably stick to that. And so I started putting more and more ideas on paper. And so some of those ideas have slowly coalesced into Romancing the Hilarity, which is a book I wrote that I'm trying to get published and hope to see published around January of this upcoming year. It's fairly exciting. About Romancing the Hilarity. Before you can become Prince Charming, you have to be Sir Not Too Bad, and before him comes Squire Tolerable. It took me a while just to get up to Squire Tolerable. I was aloof and standoffish and did so little dating that the mother of one of my best friends thought I was gay until shortly before I got married. In her defense, I was more eloquent and better dressed than any other boy in our neighborhood, and that was the easiest way for her to explain it. Romancing the Hilarity is my first offering of my tales of woe and intrigue, specifically those of a relational persuasion. So hopefully you'll be able to laugh and learn from my escapades. I'm going to read some excerpts from the book itself, and then a handful of other things that are totally tangential, either things that I've written at different points in my life, or never been written, mostly just interpreted stories that I have for you. I'm going to start and end this the exact same way. I want to invent something. I would like to invent a drink. And my drink that I'm going to invent, much like the Arnold Palmer, it's an iced tea-based drink, but instead of lemonade, it's iced tea and Mellow Yellow. So, and just call it the Mo the Third. So next time you go to a restaurant, if they have Mellow Yellow, order iced tea and Mellow Yellow, but call it a Mo the Third. And when they can't figure it out, just explain it to them. So Mo the Third, Mellow Yellow and iced tea. It's going to be a thing. But I'd like to start with a piece that I wrote for my blog. It's called Courthouse Blues. As a 29-year-old black man, I'd go out of my way not to spend time in the halls of justice. I didn't even want to go into the courthouse to pick up a marriage license. It's not that I've done anything that should get me arrested. I'm just always a tiny bit concerned with getting thrown in jail for contempt of court, and also a little bit for that parking ticket that I never paid. And everything in the USA Patriot Act and the NDAA. But mostly, it's just that I hate the guard shack. The guard shack is the worst, full of bored and/or paranoid members of the law enforcement community. This is the place where bad things happen to good, albeit absent-minded, people. To date, I've lost 3 nail files, a handful of crappy lighters, 1 Zippo, a cheap knife, and 1 Hunter Green double-hinged wine key at a series of guard shacks. Of course, by this point in my life, I've stopped carrying a knife. Not out of any kind of principled stand, mind you. I just broke the clasp off my old one, lost it, and then failed to replace it. With that track record on guard shacks, I've taken to leaving my coat and all my pocket contents I have, save ID, and whatever money or paperwork are required for that specific trip in my car or at home, whenever I'm faced with a looming specter of confiscation. As a general rule, though, I have to plan ahead. Not just trips to municipal palaces. I pre-remember as much of my life as is possible. Keys go in a certain place, phone, wallet. I once looked for my glasses for 3 days because I couldn't remember putting them 3 feet away from where they usually go, and they got covered by a single sheet of paper. It's a little funny as long as you're not living it. So if I didn't plan to go to the courthouse, my mind is still at the office, or the library, or at home, whatever. I'm getting ready to leave for the office, and the call buzzes in. It's from my brother. Do you have $100? Yes. Any chance you'd stop by the courthouse and pay my fine? I can't get there before they close, and I could do without a bench warrant. Sure, I respond, without hesitation. I knew he was good for it. And we've always been those siblings. In the 10th grade, I forgot my work shirt, and my 10-year-old brother rode his bike the 2.5 miles to bring it to me because he knew I'd need it. So, yeah, I'd pay his fine. I'll spare you the details of my tooling around the one-way street-filled labyrinth of overpriced downtown parking, and instead cut to my stepping through the double doors of the municipal building and coming face to yellow rotating beacon light with my old enemy, the guard post. And then I realize that because this is my brother's plan, I didn't pre-remember anything. I have stuff in every one of my 9 pockets. And as I begin the adventure, which is excavating all the hidden folds of my winter coat, I have the next unpleasant revelation of the day. A friend, Dave, was in a bit of a spot when the dean at his school called him into his office to say that because of an oversight by Dave's advisor and the registrar, he'd missed a prerequisite to nearly all of his classes from the previous 3 years. He had to finish that class that semester, or he'd be kicked out of the program. This was especially bad news for Dave because of the nature of the class. So I tutored him. Tutored him through the entire semester just as a favor. During all of our sessions, I'd incessantly flick any one of his knives open and closed. At our last session, Dave gifted me a Kershaw Tonto Blur, an excellent knife retailing at about $80, which I gratefully and absent-mindedly slipped into my pocket the day before my brother called me. So, as I begin the mental exercise preparing to fish coins, receipts, pens, and a veritable mountain of flotsam and jetsam from their hiding places, my hand comes first to rest on my brand new knife. And as the first person in line, I'm already face to face with the gatekeeper. The guard hands me a basket, and I give him one of those pained, "I'm sorry" looks. I have a knife in my pocket, I begin in a quiet voice, and I'd rather not throw it away. What follows is a virtual masterwork of that "you are such an idiot" look, which he holds for what feels like hours. Should I just go back to my car? I sputter out uncomfortably. "Give it to me," the guard replies flatly. I could just take it back to my car," I try again. He repeats himself with a similarly quasi-disdainful tone, and smirking says, "He'll put it in a little envelope and I can retrieve it upon my return." Uncomfortable with this new arrangement, but without much in terms of alternative, I hand over my knife and begin filling the basket destined for the x-ray machine. The ever-growing line behind me stirs, and now I'm just feeling scattered. On the other side of the machine, I begin ramming the scattered contents of the basket back into my pockets with wanton disregard for organizational scheme. The sole focus? Getting away from the derisive gaze of the guard and the impatient eyes of those trapped in line behind me. The woman behind the ultra-thick plexiglass payment window was pleasant enough, but she was definitely all business. My plan to explain that this was all on my brother's behalf was preempted entirely by the instruction to, quote, "type the social of the person on file into the keypad." Then she asked how much I'd be paying. $100, I replied, and began patting myself down to recover my money. As I smiled and dug once more, I realized that in the guard shack fiasco, my money got a bit moved around. A 20 here, a 20 there. After a minute or two, I'd reassembled 80 of the $100 I walked in with. "You could just pay the 80, she said, doing a better than average job of veiling her very likely growing impatience. In the midst of my delusion, I searched for at least another full minute as another line grew behind me. "I guess I'm just paying the 80. I sighed exasperatedly, as it dawns on me that there's a chance that I dropped the missing bill at the guard station while jamming errant papers into my pocket. Only by now, I don't even want to make eye contact with the guards. So, I shuffle back, hands in my pockets, standing by for a second till the guard recognizes me. Handing me my knife, his "next time, leave it at home" line convinces me just to give up on the money and move on with my day. Back in the car, the final 20 falls out of the folds of my jacket and into the seat beside me. For a split second, I consider going back in. Yeah, no. So, as you might have been able to interpret, I'm a fairly absent-minded guy. When I put something down, I don't so much remember where I put it as hope that I will find it when I need it next. So if a normal person puts something in, say, a pocket or on a shelf, and later they need to recover it, they think to themselves, where did I put it? Oh, in my pocket or on my shelf. Me, I begin a slow excavation that tracks sort of my general life path and says, okay, well, I probably put it on the shelf. But if not there, then it's on the counter in the bathroom. If it's not there, I have no idea, and I need to start pulling everything out of every part of my house one piece at a time until I find it. And this extends, unfortunately, to people around me, especially when I get caught up in a piece of work. So I was actually doing some writing when I was younger. I was home at my parents' house in Ohio, and the computer sits in the dining room at a perfect vantage point, actually, to see the entire first floor. So in theory, the person who's sitting at the computer knows exactly what's going on basically in the entire house. So I had been working for quite some time. My dad was upstairs. My mom walks into the dining room and says, "Morris, where's your father?" To which I respond fairly casually, "He's upstairs." She takes a moment and looks at me. "Morris, the car's gone." "Oh," I reply. "Then I guess he's not here." She sighed exasperatedly and walked away. And that's generally how my life operates. I don't quite remember things as they go on. I sometimes, occasionally, am able to dig deep and remember where I put my car keys, but for the most part, I have to find them every time they're not in my hand. So this next piece is a piece that's from the book itself, and it's just called The Birds and the Bees. To paraphrase the late Mitch Hedberg, may he rest in peace, I used to be a nerd. I still am, but I used to be too. When I was about 10, I started to get curious. While Kevin McAllister and my peers were rummaging through the locked chests and sock drawers of their older brothers and fathers, I wasn't. I waited until no one was around, walked into our living room, pulled out the S volume of our family's 1992 edition of the World Book Encyclopedia, and flipped it open to sex, and read the following: "See sexual intercourse." Bam! I learned something already. So after turning to sexual intercourse, I read the article and learned that it has something to do with privates, and I really didn't get anything useful out of it. Thanks a lot, World Book Encyclopedia Company. Now, in the fifth grade, my parents sent me to a little Christian school. If you went to Christian school, it was just like you remember. If you didn't, it was basically the movie Saved, without the pregnant girl, the Jewish girl, or the kid in the wheelchair, which is a shame because they were awesome and would have made my school experience way more exciting. Marilyn Manson did go to my school, but that was before my time. And there was a sex scandal, but that was after my time. So while I was there, the only thing notable about the school was that it was a Christian school, which is still pretty noteworthy when you have to tackle something like sex ed. It's also a big deal when you have a science class where you're not allowed to ask questions about evolution, but in middle school, sex ed seemed way more important. In the sixth grade, my classmates and I got to study the book Preparing for Adolescence by Dr. James Dobson. Dr. Dobson, if you're not familiar, is the founder of Focus on the Family. And he wrote a book about our development and changing bodies, which basically said, chew ice chips and pray till you're married. So, yeah, I'm paraphrasing, but that was the gist of it. Early in our time studying the book, our teacher, Mr. T, opened up the floor for preliminary questions. Ask about whatever. His proposal was met with deafening silence. It's not that we weren't interested. It's just that this particular teacher had a bit of a temper. He didn't respond well to things he didn't like. One day when the class was a little restless, Mr. T famously slammed a textbook on a table and shouted, "Shut the door!" To one of the kids. The book slam was more noteworthy because than it might otherwise have been, because with a reddening face and bulging veins, you could see him choking back far harsher language than what came out. It really came out, "Shut the door!" And for the WASPy kids in that class, that was pretty overwhelming. So Shut the Door Man wanted us to ask him any questions we wanted about puberty. We passed on that particular offer. But as a teacher, he couldn't let it go. So he called out a specific student by name. "Student, I can tell you have a question. Ask it." "No thanks. Just ask." "I don't feel..." "Student, ask your question." My classmate looks down at his desk and mutters, "What was that?" Mr. T demands. "When I get married, will I stop having sex dreams?" The room actually managed to get even quieter as Mr. T sent one of the 5 iciest stares I've ever seen in my life across the room to the student. "Get out. Just go to the office. Right now." And that, in a nutshell, was my Christian school experience with sex ed. If the private school systems fail you, you can always turn to your family, right? The birds and the bees talk wasn't one of the things to which I looked forward. It's not that my dad's not a good guy. In fact, he's one of the better people I know. He's thoughtful, helpful, good at most of the basic dad stuff. He taught me how to throw a football, to change my oil, to tie a tie. But romance and feelings didn't play to his strengths. So telling me about women and sex and all that jazz was going to be a tough one. Reading a book in my room one afternoon in the summer leading into high school, I was surprised when my dad walked into my room. It wasn't necessarily surprising that he was in my room, but he was fairly good about knocking. The fact that he didn't now worried me more than a little. He looked uncomfortably in my doorway for a moment, while I marked my spot in my book with my finger. "Well," he began, "you're old enough now that you've probably figured out your own attitudes on dating and stuff like that." I guess, I responded, shrugging into my book to avoid eye contact while bracing for what would likely be the most awkward conversation of my life to that point. "Well, okay then," he said. And then, as suddenly as he'd come, he was gone. And that, in a nutshell, was the rest of my experience with sex ed. I'm not entirely sure how I made it to adulthood. It's complicated. Every relationship status on Facebook should end with, "It's complicated." Let's be honest. Whatever point of the spectrum which you happen to find yourself, it's either complicated or you're lying to yourself. It doesn't mean it's bad, just that there's another layer. And I've got news for you. Status is like an onion. An onion. When you peel away the last layer, there might not be anything left. Single, somebody's dream, is someone else's nightmare. Dane Cook talks about singleness in terms of not being invited to a party that everyone else seems to be attending. But it's complicated. Some days you're living the life, enjoying time and space, tickets for one, and popcorn all to yourself, casual dates, and the sky's the limit. Other times, or for other people, you are in the valley of the shadow of death. You want to ride along with someone else, even if they do drive from the passenger side. Your own bed feels a bit too cold, and even if they spill a few kernels in your lap, you wish there was another hand in the popcorn bucket. Or maybe you don't. When chatting with a stranger of the opposite sex, you spend at least half the time figuring out if they're flirting with you, or really just asking if you'd like to add an apple pie for a dollar. Every incarnation every interaction is a chance to flirt. I mean, fall in love. I mean, get rejected. It's complicated. Then, of course, there's the standard incarnation. It's just complicated. And that covers a multitude of sins. Unrequited love, friends with benefits, it's complicated. You dumped your partner to send a message, and he or she won't take you back. Everyone wants you, but the one you want. You think you're dating, but you're not sure if the other person feels the same way, so you change your status so maybe she'll take the hint. It's complicated. You just got out of a serious relationship, but you're really into this new person, but you don't want to date just yet. It's complicated. The two of you have been doing stuff together. He or she's really into her career or school right now. Then, but he or she always seems to get super gushy and sentimental when you think maybe you're making headway in the relationship and it'll really become something. You find out that you're the person on the side and the significant other just found out about the two of you, but you still really like him or her. A lot more than you should. Get off my back, it's complicated. Then, of course, there's the status. In a relationship, engaged, married, and when you get there, complicated goes to a whole new level. Dating. Usually you feel like you've known each other forever. Sometimes you're staring at the other person wondering, who on earth am I talking to? You've got this pseudo-psychic connection, teamwork thing going on. Until you don't. Then you're at each other's throats for misinterpreting your thoughts. You're still trying to figure out the drill with one another's families, wanting to make a good impression but not wanting to kiss up. You put on slacks and a tie but stop short of agreeing with the folks on politics and religion. The whole thing's an awkward mess of telling the other person what you think they want to hear and showing them more and more of who you really are. Hitch says it well. She may not want the whole truth, but she does want the real you. She may not want it all at once, but she does want to see it. Then, of course, there's the piece de resistance. Because at the end of the day, it's your job not to mess it up. So you're trying to be Superman, Clark Kent, and Lex Luthor all at the same time. It's complicated, and that's putting it kindly. Then somebody pops the question. How about we do this dance until one of us kicks the bucket? So now you're trying to sort out what comes next. You're picking out flowers, your families are meeting up, you're not sure how that's going to play out, you don't think that your uncle will mesh with anyone in your fiancé's family. Or anyone in civilized society, to be perfectly honest. What's going to stay? What's going for good? If you're the groom, your bride might hate your best man. As the bride, you're pretty sure you saw your groom checking out the in-from-out-of-town bridesmaid. And there's the stifling truth that a whole lot of things which have never been in the same room will suddenly be living under the same roof. If that's not complicated, I don't know what is. I now pronounce you happily confused. You're married. Suddenly you're sharing life in a way you never have. You have someone to shop with, to eat with, to think with, to drive with, to sleep with, and to fight with. You learn about each other in a fresh and exciting way. She likes the blinds closed at night. You like them open. He listens to audiobooks, and you don't want him to play them on the house stereo because they make you sleepy. You learn a lot about yourself in a completely new way. You really like to cuddle, but only for a little while. But she doesn't like it when you extricate yourself. Sex is new and exciting and emotionally loaded. Sometimes it's awesome. Other times, a joke pops into your head and you laugh out loud at the absolute worst time. You try to explain that you weren't entirely in the moment, but now it's really complicated. 10 years and a whole lot of early mornings and late dinners later, it's blurry all over again. When the things that were cute become the things which grind your gears, it's complicated. The movie Mr. and Mrs. Smith has one great example after another of the normalization of the craziness that is two lives smashed together. A linchpin of this particular craziness, a linchpin of this particular dinner scene is a discussion of the addition of peas, and the entire conversation which serves as a relational shield between the two of them, and the mass of secrets each hides. Do they love each other? Yeah, Underneath all the rubble of faded passion, divergent dreams, cultural variances, nervous tics, unnatural habits, they love each other. But you have to get past the dirty clothes on the floor, the unprompted sob fest, his bad taste in clothing, her too meticulous attention to detail, and everything else to find the fact that she likes lilacs over roses 10-1, or that he always smiles when you cheer for his team, and that some things you do never cease to bring your partner off the edge. It all sucks until she holds you. It's complicated. So basically, if you're alone, together, in love, in hate, seeing each other socially, bumping into each other on the street, dating, fighting, flirting, cleanly broken up or not quite over each other, married, pining, engaged, or just plain dating, it's complicated. So those were two pieces from the actual work itself, Romancing the Hilarity. And now I'm just kind of going to talk to you about some other things that contributed to my life as I know it. I was a homeschooler, which is kind of an interesting thing. I wasn't homeschooled for the entire time. I was homeschooled for all the early years and then a handful of the later years of my scholastic career. But it was a lot of fun, and it was a great opportunity for my parents to be very hands-on in our education, which I really appreciate, because as a reader, I would get way ahead in a lot of subjects, and so I tested out of a lot of subjects very, very early on in my academic career. But other areas, like my maths and my sciences, I didn't spend nearly as much time doing work as I should have, and my mom was right there to make sure, no, you do have to do these subjects even though you don't like them. But the great thing about homeschooling is you can connect with other people, and there's organizations and networks. And one of my best friends, his name is Dan, he was a good friend of mine since my early childhood. And Dan was the fitness guy. He could handle reading, but he preferred working out, the running around, the throwing things. He was on all of the traveling sports teams. In fact, as an example, he and two other athlete friends of his, one day they decided for fun, and they set out running. And their goal was just to run for the entire day. And they did. They did laps around this lake. I don't understand it. To this day, I don't understand. I ran cross country and I still don't understand it. I thought that a great day was waking up with a book that I hadn't started yet, reading all day until the sun went down. That was a great day for me during around that same period. But when you're a homeschooler, you have to fulfill certain athletic requirements or the gym expectation. And so the deal that we had, Dan would come to my house early in the morning, and he had mapped out this 5-mile running route that he took all around the city near where we lived. And so he would pick me up early in the morning, and he was nice enough to take my backpack, because we would make stops occasionally and pick stuff up or drop things off or do whatever. And so he would carry my backpack so I didn't have to worry about it, and then we would set off together on his five mile trail early in the morning. Now, this was definitely not my favorite thing. It tended to wear me out. He was always fine. I was always worn out at the end. And this was especially bad one day. Now, the first 4 miles of the particular day, no problem. I was just humming along. He was humming along, pounding the pavement. And he joked with me so that I could survive, so that I could make it through the 5 miles. He would joke with me all the time. So we made it through the first 4 miles, no problem. But right around that switch over to into the fifth mile, I broke my bike chain and had to walk the rest of the time because he had been picking me up. He ran with my backpack and I rode my bike because there was no way I was going to be able to keep up with him on foot. So it was a lot of fun and he loved it. We lived our lives together, and in fact, after we both finished up college, we went to college, he went to Oklahoma and I went to Pennsylvania for college, but after we were both finished up, the two of us moved down to D.C. with a third friend that I went to school with, and so we were living in D.C. together, which included all sorts of crazy stories all by itself, but he got me my first table waiting job. I've served in different capacities all through my life, waited tables at a lot of cool, cool places. It's been fun. It's always, always full of stories. But one particular time, I walked out of the area where the servers were preparing, and this lady just charges up to me. She has nothing but hate in her eyes, and I'm concerned because you know that what's about to come, what's about to come next is just kind of a scary situation. And so she begins to sort of berate me. She's talking about all the things that I did that have ruined her and her guests' dining experience. And I'm horrified, not just because I've done all these things wrong and I'm being yelled at, but because I don't remember. And as being an absent-minded person, I feel like there's a chance that everything she's saying is true. And then I realize where she came from. She came from a section that wasn't my section. She came from the section of the only other black server that we have, who also happens to be 3 or so inches taller than me, not wearing glasses, several shades lighter than me, and wearing a different colored shirt. She's certain that I am her server and is just going crazy. And so I'm trying kind of to explain this, that there's a mistaken identity, but we can fix all these problems. And so she sort of huffs off and I recover and walk back into the line where the rest of the servers are. And I say, Pat, well, the bad news is table 35 hates you. They're really upset with pretty much everything that you've done all night tonight. The good news is I'm pretty sure she's worn out from screaming at me, so now would be the best time for you to go back out there and do something about it. It was definitely an interesting moment right then. But he went out and he was really grateful that I took the bullet for him. I didn't do it on purpose, but he was thrilled that's the way that whole thing worked out. But some friends of mine and I, who also worked in the restaurant, tried to start a server-based magazine. One for something that tells some of the interesting stories, because like I said, you get to see the spectrum. Great customers. I've seen people that share appetizers with strangers, or guests of the restaurant that see somebody else having a bad day and have paid for the entire check of the different tables. And so we tried to form a sort of a magazine targeting servers. It didn't work because, much like you see depicted in films, servers can be extremely ambitious. They are the most ambitious slackers you will ever want to meet. And so we had a bunch of great ideas, but we never got off the ground with it. But I did write this piece, and it's just called Good Customers, and it's just kind of a fun, short piece. Great customers. A good customer is a gift. An incredible table is a diamond wrapped in a winning lottery ticket. The circumstances surrounding a good table are numerous and varied. So many things go into a good table that even if someone unlocked a universal combination for success, it would be too vast to keep all of that in your conscious mind. That being said, every day, every shift, every table is a roll of the dice. Walk to my table. Military. Ex-military, more likely. Her hair is a little long, and his facial hair is a little too unkempt. Middle 50s is my best guess. I walk up to the table. It's really early in the shift, and I'm hoping for a winner of a night. These two look extra serious. I'm not really sure what they're up for, so I test the waters. If they're open to suggestions, I'll turn up the charm. If they're set in their ways, it's the efficiency model, not a problem. I scroll over and lean slightly against the open table behind me, looking from her to him. The unsmiling faces blink back at me. They've seen overenthusiastic, and it doesn't impress them. I scrap my opener and throw out shot in the dark. You're having a Foster's, I start, hoping just to encourage a beer, even if that wasn't on their to-do list. No, wait, a Sam Adams. I change, thinking that the old-school Navy man would be an American beer, but a man with his tastes would want something a little better than a Miller Lite. The seconds of still, unsmiling silence did little to encourage me. When she spoke, as opposed to him, I feared that they were a pair of teetotalers who were offended at the suggestion of alcohol. You're absolutely right. That's incredible. He'll have a Sam Adams, and I'll have a Captain and Coke with a lime, light ice. The shock on their faces accurately reflected my own. As I took their appetizer order and walked away, beaming at my absurd good luck. peppering my service with just the right amount of formality and throwing in ma'am and sir for good measure, the three of us got on famously. Filet orders from both of them and a round of drinks later, these two guests, in a brief chat with the floor manager, raved about my attentive service and thoughtful behavior, commenting later that they were both retired Navy and they appreciated my focus and felt that I had made their dining experience all the more wonderful. A 30% tip later, it was official. That was the beginning of a very good night. Another piece from the book, Almost a Schoolyard Romance. Like I said, in the fifth grade, my parents sent me and my siblings to a small private school near our house. As an unusual young man just entering the awkward pubescent years, starting a new school was exciting, and a guaranteed challenge. Now, when I assert that I was an unusual kid, I'm not playing up the hype. I'm understating the strangeness. My two favorite activities at that age were playing chess and reading. My heroes, Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes and Star Trek's Mr. Spock, encouraged me to a life of observation and reflection. A thinking, chess-playing, eyebrow-raising child who threw around phrases like, it's elementary, and affirmative, had a lot of time to philosophize on his own. My observations on love and the comings and goings of life led me to the conclusion that romances that predate the latter half of high school were realistically doomed. Picture an 11-year-old kid trying to convince a group of his changing classmates that dating is counterproductive to the process of self-discovery. I got a lot of questions, curious glances, and even some nods of acknowledgement around the sound nature of my logic, but not nearly as many converts to my way of thinking. The problem with being an overly logical child in puberty is that if you don't want to date, you spend a lot of time crushing quietly. In the fifth and sixth grade, I had a crush on this girl. We'll call her Sue. Sue was a really nice girl, kind of opinionated and cute. She challenged me to a rope jumping competition in fifth grade. I won handily, thanks to my father's old school sports training. After that, we chatted with some regularity, to the chagrin of her boyfriend. Being in the fifth grade, it was only a matter of time before candy became the topic of conversation. At one point, she explained to me that she hated grape-flavored candy. Being a logical kid, I said something eloquent, like, yeah, grape candy sucks. Now, there's one problem with my saying, yeah, grape candy sucks. I believed that you should do what you say, and I had just said that I didn't like grape candy. I immediately developed a deep, deep hatred for grape candy, and I was an adult before I had another piece. It was a blow pop, and it was great. I was home visiting after college, and I ran into Sue at a movie theater. A lot of stuff fades in a decade, but the first thing that popped into my head when I saw her was the grape candy exaggeration. I doubt that even Sue remembered that I didn't like grape candy either. Nevertheless, she wouldn't have been able to convince me to give up grape candy again. And even though I don't much care for it, blow pops being a notable exception, I'm not crushing on Sue anymore. I had mostly gotten over my crush on Sue by the eighth grade. I had found my next true like. We'll call her Anne. Anne and I didn't have the rope jumping connection, but when your entire graduating class is less than 40 students, you get to know about everyone. Anne was nice to me, even when the other members of my class were less so. In hindsight, perhaps she was just defending a slightly bullied new-ish kid, but I fell for her like only a middle school boy can. Being in the final stretch of middle school, it was extremely difficult to toe the hard line of not dating. I even lost track of it for a few moments that year. As an ex-homeschooler in junior high, though, smooth, I was not. Smart? Yeah. Nice? Absolutely. Occasionally, I was even funny. But smoothness was a trait well beyond my grasp. So, when I decided to try and make my affections to Anne known, I didn't know what to do. There wasn't much of a chance of my telling her what I was thinking and feeling. I hadn't progressed much beyond my poking a girl and running away phase in terms of that particular brand of conversation. So with conversation off the table, I thought flowers would serve my end. Now I know what you're thinking. Good job, kid. Women like flowers. Great plan, kid. Yeah, but when I pirated a single carnation from the funeral I attended 2 days ago, it didn't exactly send the message that I had in my mind. Less so when instead of handing it to her, I wedged it through the handle in her locker before school started, and then never mentioned it. I did finally get around to saying something to Anne, and by saying something, I mean I gave her a note. And by gave, I mean I handed it to someone who handed it to someone who handed it to her. While we were on our bus tour from our class trip in D.C. I obviously didn't just jump right in and tell her that I liked her. We passed a few notes worth of inane chit-chat. Then I asked her if maybe we could do something together sometime, because I kinda liked her. When I got back an enthusiastic yes response, I was too distracted to notice that the handwriting was completely different, and that the person who signed it wasn't her. It was a boy whose name happened to begin with the same letters as hers, next to whom she just happened to be sitting. I was a little hurt. By the time we got back from our trip, I'd once again given up the idea of dating before the end of high school. And I guess, in the long run, that's okay. I wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but it helped make me the person that I am. The person who finally figured out that talking is more important than a flower in a locker, and that it pays to have fewer people between you and the person to whom you're talking. I have one last piece that I'm really excited to share with you, and this is one that I wrote. It was an experience that I had when I was living down in D.C. I just call it God is in my coffee. It's not in the book, but you can find it on my blog, and there's information about my blog on the cards in the seat. So it's called God is in my coffee. Shortly after settling into my D.C. digs, I stopped going to church. It was a decision part antagonist, part apathy, part internal conflict, but for more than a year, I wasn't attending any church regularly. When I was in church, it was as uncomfortable as a badly cut suit. If I was lucky, there was the awkward visitor glad-handing, big toothy smiles, knuckle-crunching greetings, and the stilted conversation which shields us from penetrating conversations, deep thoughts, or worse, silence. You have to give them marks, though. Enthusiastic, but a touch overwhelming. The other option is even less appealing. You walk in alone, you sing the songs, you listen to the message, and you go home alone. No greetings, no goodbyes, and, lucky for the congregants, you didn't upset the balance of their day. You could have watched a TV church service to the exact same end. After a few such visiting experiences, I settled into a regular living routine, and the church wasn't part of that routine. Work, write, sleep, play, repeat. Life goes on, and my roommate and I moved from our little place on the outskirts to a microscopic place right in the thick of it. I was still working near the old place, so on a regular day, getting to work was an hour-long trip of a train and a bus. On an irregular day, it was 3 buses and 2.5 hours of think time. And on those irregular days, I passed this church called Mosaic. It reminded me of a cool-looking church I'd read about over on the West Coast. I thought about stopping in some Sunday, but the people on the bus go up and down, and it was never more than a thought. Half a year elapses. I'm living and working in the thick of it, but some of my friends in best-thinking spots were still on the outskirts. So every once in a while, I found myself repeating my irregular days on purpose. All the while, Mosaic sat at the side of the route, beautiful older architecture and an inviting new sign. I was going to go on Sunday, but I overslept Sunday school and didn't want to make myself that guy as soon as I walked in the door. Maybe next week. Days and months roll on, and I'm heading up to New England to be in the wedding of a very good friend. 688 miles from my childhood home in Canton, and 436 miles from D.C. So, the bride introduces me to her former roommate from her off-campus semester in Michigan, of whom she'd spoken years ago, because she was attending Malone College in Canton, where I grew up. And now, she's introduced us at her wedding, and her roommate is living in, ding, D.C., our nation's capital. Our shared connections get us started, and we chat over the course of the festivities. Do you have a church in the area? No, I visited a few. I'm kind of passively looking at this point. Well, you should visit my church. It's called Mosaic. Let's recap that. So, I went to New Hampshire for a wedding, met a girl who grew up in my hometown, who roomed with my friend, who studied in Michigan, and who lived in D.C., and attended the only church which I'd considered going to. That's a little much to just be a coincidence. So, immediately upon my return, I didn't go. I wavered and waffled and stayed home. I decided to go to church again, one Saturday night, the same way that people give up smoking. Only this time, when I woke up late on that Saturday morning, despite my guarantee of tardiness and the risk of being that guy, I dusted myself off, hopped on the bus for the longest trip of my life. I rolled along, as uncomfortable as anyone can be. While, on a purely social level, large groups are my favorite, there's something raw about being at a church. All the more for a church that one has no knowledge of, save the captivating sign and the hope that a single familiar face might be at the gathering. When the bus arrived at my destination, I didn't know what to do. I walked over to the front of the building and just stood there, staring up at the building. The two doors were open, and I gazed through the foyer into the sanctuary, and I started in, every step a hesitation. Not sure why I'm here, and not sure where to go next. Starbucks and the book in my bag are sounding more and more appealing. I stepped through the foyer into the back of the sanctuary, and I just stood there. My head on a swivel, I teetered on the edge. A stiff breeze, and I was gone with the wind. The people in the church weren't doing the typical pre-service milling. They were gathered around two large round tables, eating breakfast. They're eating. I'm standing, and I don't know what to do. There's a young woman, maybe 13 years old, standing in the corner, rocking out on a by-the-cup coffee maker. I watched her for a second. "Hi, would you like some coffee?" she offered with a smile that did not say, "Welcome to our church." Her smile greeted me like family. "We've been expecting you. We're so glad you made it." I will never be able to encapsulate the warmth that washed over me in words. I will never be able to. I felt what I can only express as God's love radiating off of her, like the light of the sun off of the moon. Years of cynicism and disillusionment came off like the armor of a battle which has been won. And the church enfolded me into its body. A mosaic is a collection of broken pieces that come together, and in their brokenness, they create something bigger, something beautiful, something eternal. Being a part of that community reminded me why I wanted to be a Christian. All right, now I told you I was going to leave you on this note also. Don't forget, when you go out next time to eat, you're going to order a Mo the Third, Mellow Yellow, and iced tea. It's going to be a thing. Follow me on Twitter if you tweet at Mo the Third. I have a Facebook page, a blog, and an About Me. Check out those things, and I will see you guys on the internet. And maybe in real life, too.